Thanks, Tim. Wow, so we get to the end of 1 Thessalonians, and Paul is writing, and Paul often does this, as he's writing his letters, he'll end up with this laundry list of things to do, of just last minute, oh yeah, I forgot to say that you should do this too. These reminders, sometimes they're gentle, sometimes you're at the church in Corinth and they're not so gentle, and there's this pattern of these things, and yet they're hard. They're super hard. I was reading over this verse and studying for today, and I hit this list of things, and okay, so be at peace with everyone. All right, I'm done. Right there. I mean, really, I can't even go further than that, but if I did, rejoice always. Yeah, because that happens. Right? Pray continually. You know, I can remember as a kid reading through this, I really got caught up in that phrase, pray without ceasing was the way it was translated, or pray continually. I mean, really, as a teenage boy, teenage me, trying to figure this thing out, what do you do with that? Because I can't stay home and pray. I can't. I've got to go to work. I've got to go to school. I've got things to do. I've got girls to... girls to talk to. I needed to go play games with my friends. You know, yeah, there's always something else to do. We're not people who can just sit at home in our rooms and pray all the time. And so I would read this and I'd go, what on earth are we supposed to do with that? I mean, how do we obey that command? And the worst part of it is I've gotten older. I've realized that it's even worse than I thought. Because I was just focusing on this one little bit. And it's funny, as you read the great fathers of the faith and you look at what they say about things like this, Luther realized he was in kind of the same boat. And he did it in a very different way. He did it while sitting at the dinner table with some of his students. And somewhere in the middle of their dinner conversation, I just sort of imagine this coming out of left field. Luther, you know, enjoying the meat course and talking with the students, and they're debating theology, and they go back and forth, and he finally says, you know what? I wish I could pray like my dog. And everybody said, what? He said, no, look at him. Look at how he stares at the piece of meat. Look at how every fiber of his being, from his nose all the way down to his tail, is focused with such intensity on this one small point, this one hope, this one thing. I want to learn to pray like that. And you read that and you realize you're in more trouble than you thought. And then you read the scripture this morning and you realize it's not just pray continually. It is rejoice always. It's don't repay evil for evil. It's be at peace with everyone. It's so incredibly tough. It's a question of what is it that drives us? What do we breathe in? What consumes us? What consumes you? You know, for some of us, I've known people in my life where that's pain. Where sometimes it's physical pain, where there's a medical issue and there's something wrong and they're living with that. And they become defined by their pain. More often, that's this emotional pain. Where something has happened sometime in the past, somebody said something or did something or whatever, and that relationship got shattered. And in the process, you got broken too. In the process, something inside was irrevocably hurt. It's still bleeding. You're still trying to cope with that, and that you're doing it by keeping everybody else at arm's length. That you're doing it by pushing everybody else back. C.S. Lewis talked about this phenomenon, and he said, you know what? If you love, you're gonna get hurt. If you love anything at all, from a puppy to a person, you're gonna get hurt. It's part of the deal. In fact, the only way you'll be safe from hurt is to never love anything at all. To push it all back and to take your heart and to seal it up in a deep, dark place and leave it there untouched and unbroken. and it'll be safe. But in its safety, it will harden and it will change and it will become something totally unlike it was meant to be. We can't live that way. As long as we're bound by pain, as long as we live our lives in fear of being hurt, we can never learn to love. We can never really be consumed in the ways we're supposed to be. Some of us get consumed in our relationships. You know, we've seen it. I have three teenage girls, so I hear lots of stories right now. You know, and I see how these relationships get fractured and broken, and how you have these people who simply can't go more than 2.5 seconds without having a boyfriend or a girlfriend. It's actually somewhere in the DNA. It's required. Because as long as I have that, then I have value. As long as there's somebody out there who will point to me and say, yes, you matter to me, that then that's okay and I'm okay. And that means that if that's the most important thing, if that's what I'm consumed by, then I'm willing to lay everything down for that. And that's a dangerous place to be. Sometimes it's family. Sometimes we've got those toxic relationships in our family where we've gotten them out of perspective, where we love someone so much and we've poured so much into them that we can't imagine letting go of them. We can't imagine ever having any kind of distance there. And it's that sort of dependence and what psychologists are even going to call codependence, where we're stuck with each other, that can breed this unhealthy relationship, this love that's not like it's meant to be, where I'm giving to you and pouring into you and loving you, and you're doing the same to me, and we're lifting each other up. But this love where I'm pouring and pouring and pouring, it's just not working. And I'm reminding you, over time, of course, with that, I get upset and I get bitter and I get broken. And so I start reminding you that I've poured and I've poured and I've poured. And eventually, instead of lifting each other up, we're dragging each other down, destroying each other. You know those relationships. You've seen them. Those toxic ones that don't make one another better. They just consume us in ways we're not meant to be. Some of us get consumed by success, by achievement. Man, I wrestle with this one. This is where I live and breathe sometimes. Wanting to do that next thing, climb that next hill, achieve that next step, whatever it is. It doesn't even really matter if it's a video game or a new master's degree or whatever. That next step in professional development and personal development, whatever. And those can be good things. In fact, all these things that we're talking about can be good things. Loving people and being willing to be hurt. Pouring into the people around us, even driving to ambition and success. But when it gets out of perspective, when ambition gets out of line, well, then it's never enough. And you keep going and you keep climbing and you keep chasing. A next step, next mountain, next achievement. Until the day comes when your foot slips and you find yourself on the fall down the mountain. And the fall kills us. If you're consumed by that, fall's not something you can take. I wonder, as I was writing, I wonder still now, what does it really look like to be consumed by God? Because really, that's what Paul's talking about here. This whole pray without ceasing, rejoice continually. Love, be at peace with people around you. Don't repay evil for evil. This is looking at the world living through the cross. What does that look like? Because over the years, I've known people who tried to do that, that was what they were really trying to live out. And it's kind of funny because, I did my vicarage. It's our internship when you're at seminary back in 2000. They sent me down to University of Florida in Gainesville, which was just a really tough place to pull, let me tell you. Had to spend a year down there doing campus ministry, and it was awesome. But for the first, like, 3 months, I couldn't figure it out. I would go to people, and I would meet college students, and I'd be talking with them, say, yeah, I'm over at First Lutheran. I'm the new campus minister here, and we're trying to really get things going. And as soon as I said the words campus minister, like, the eyes glazed over, they shut off, and they were looking for an escape route. Like, what is my graceful way to say, okay, I'm out of here? Even people I knew were Christians, even people who would ordinarily have had a conversation with me, were done as soon as I said those words, and I couldn't figure it out until the day I was walking around campus and I met the campus ministers at University of Florida. And these are guys that don't necessarily do the whole, you know, college and career ministry thing or the whole seminary thing or any of that. What they actually do is a box and a bullhorn. And they stand on their box and they use their bullhorn to call out the sins they see in the people around them walking by. And so they would accuse these girls who were walking by wearing shorts of all kinds of immorality because they were wearing shorts. Where I come from, that just means you shopped at Target or something. Come on. You know, and over and over and over, railing against all of these different sins. And they're not the first I've seen do that, and they're not the last. And I stopped calling myself a campus minister after that. It wasn't worth it. But the thing is, it doesn't work. It doesn't work on the witnessing front, just to be upfront about that. I mean, how many people become Christians because they lose the argument? Really? I mean, why do we insist on witnessing in this way? This doesn't work. So there's that piece, but I think there's a deeper level here where when we become focused primarily on proclaiming the law, proclaiming the way that other people don't measure up to God's standards, I think psychologically what's going on here is we're redirecting. It's not really about the girl wearing shorts. It's about hiding my sin. It's about me being able to say, you know what, this, because you are such a horrible, awful sinner, and I'm deliberately pointing over here where there's nobody, because of that, it means you won't look at me. And I won't be exposed for the brokenness that I carry with me too. That if I can just shout loud enough and scream loud enough, then maybe, just maybe, you'll believe that I'm really holy and pure. And maybe if you believe that, then I'll believe it too someday. And then we can start convincing God, right? Because that's how that works. No. If the gospel of Christ is all about learning how to hide our sin from one another, we're in trouble. Because A, we're not good at it, and B, it doesn't do any good. And so I think, I had a member of my church in Georgia, it was brilliant. I really love older folks, because that filter that I still wear, where I don't really say what I'm thinking, a lot of them don't have it. And it's awesome, because it means they can stand up and get away with saying all of the things I'm already thinking. And this wonderful lady named Dorothy was driving through the Walmart parking lot in Noonan, Georgia, and we had one of those guys there on the corner constantly wearing a sign reminding me how I deserve hell or whatever it was this week, and had his bullhorn proclaiming his stuff. And Dorothy finally told me, Pastor, I couldn't take it. I couldn't handle it. And finally one day, I just pulled my car up beside him, and I rolled down my window. And I said, and you have to just imagine Dorothy, she's this, you know, short little old lady, as kind and sweet as can possibly be. And she rolled down her window and she looked at him and said, that is so very nice. Now shut up and go home. And I was, yes. Yes, absolutely. Because the reality is that redirecting attention from her sin doesn't work. What works is remembering what we've already talked about this morning, remembering the cross. Coming to the conversation, coming to life, owning our brokenness, owning the reality that we fall short, owning the places where we've done harm, owning the hurt we've caused, the pain we've done. And starting from that then, knowing the cross of Christ, that God has loved us with an eternal love, knowing that we're forgiven, knowing that you're forgiven. You don't have to keep running. You don't have to keep climbing. You don't have to depend on that relationship. You don't have to be afraid of being hurt. You don't need any of those things because the cross of Christ has already said you are enough. You don't have to do more. You don't have to perform better. You don't have to achieve more. You are enough. And so when Paul's writing and he says, be at peace with all people, that flows out of that place, that knowledge and that awareness. When he says, don't repay evil for evil, that's tough because when somebody hurts me, the first thing I want to do is ball that up and throw it back at them. Harder and faster and meaner. But the cross says, no, I've taken that already. It stops here and we don't need to keep doing that thing. When we say, rejoice always, it flows out of the cross. Being aware of what God has done for us. That we are forgiven and free and we can live that out in joy and kindness. We say pray continually. Doesn't mean we got to go become monks and live in our room. It means living in this constant awareness of the presence of God. Constantly looking at the world through the eyes he has given us. Constantly looking to see where is the kingdom of heaven breaking forth right here, right now in this place. Focusing on that and lifting it up and pointing it out for the world to see. So that they can, through that, see the cross and the hope that we have. Lifting those things up for the world. Cultivating that awareness, that presence. Being consumed not with self-righteousness, but with Christ's righteousness. With his love, his grace, and his mercy. I got to tell you, it's easy to forget. You know, and as the praise team comes forward, I want to stop a moment here at the table. Because it's so easy for me to lose sight of that. Did I mention I have three teenagers? You know, it's so easy to get distracted by the next thing. To forget to look at the world through those eyes. To forget to stop and think. To stop and pray. The reality for me, at least, is that I need something to hold on to. I need things I can touch and see and taste. So we gather at this table every week, not because we really like the taste of the wafers or the wine, but because this meal here means something more than that, that in, with, and under this bread, this wine, is a very real presence of Christ's body and blood given for us. A way we can taste and see, we can touch and know that he has filled us, that he has redeemed us, that he has consumed us so that we can go out from there. Our Lord Jesus Christ, on the night in which he was betrayed, took bread. And when he had given thanks, he broke it and he gave it to his disciples and said, take and eat. This is my body broken for you. This do in remembrance of me. In the same way also, he took the cup after supper. And when he had given thanks, he gave it to them, saying, drink of it, all of you. This cup is the new covenant in my blood, poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins. As often as you drink it, do so in remembrance of me.